coming to get you, Barbara. They're coming for you, Barbara. Look, there comes one of them now.
Hello and welcome to this episode of the Movie Breakdown. We are coming to you after Thanksgiving. That's right. If you were a listener from the States, you would probably still be recovering from a belly full of holiday goodness. So welcome in. We've already recovered from our turkey overindulgences back in October, and we are here to celebrate now the path to Christmas with probably one of the most underrated Christmas movies, Enemy Mine, starring Dennis Quaid and Louis Gossett Jr. And we're going to be diving deep into this Christmas holiday film, although you may, if you've seen it or you're listening, you may think, I don't remember any holiday reference. Stick around and see if that's true or not. I'm Scott Martin.
I am Christopher Spicer. And what's that? Did you hear? You heard intro music? You heard Scott introducing the episode? That's right. It's not me warning you. It's another rerun. We have a new episode this week, and it is Enemy Mine. And that means our new episode is brought to you by our hosts over at Spreaker Prime, where we, along with a whole bunch of podcasts there to entertain your ears. And of course, you can also find this podcast, The Movie Breakdown, at our pop culture site, Beyond the Balcony, at beyondbalcony.com. And we are indeed doing Enemy Mine. One of the things is sort of when we sort of pick these episodes, I often sort of try to think of things of like what is going to, one of the aspects is looking at things that we want to talk about, but also look at one of those aspects is sort of what is going to bring in the listeners? What's going to up the downloads? What's going to increase our podcast? That's something you have to do when you're a creator. You have to sort of think of your audience. And I knew right off the bat that Enemy Mine is probably not going to sort of take the world on fire and be one of our most listened to podcasts of the year. But what intrigued me of picking this one was the fact that a few weeks ago, we both basically brought up Enemy Mine as this childhood gem, as this picture from our childhood that we really liked. And for the longest time, I kind of thought Enemy Mine was sort of this, like this thing that I kind of liked, but no one else really remembered it. And then Scott referenced it, and it got me really excited. It made me sort of think, oh, I kind of wanted to talk about this picture now. And sort of doing a bit of research on the show, this does look like it's actually a cult hit. And so there is potential that there may be even a lot of other people that are like, wow, I remember that movie, and will want to listen to us talk about Enemy Mine. And it kind of got me thinking about sort of what was it that made Enemy Mine kind of catch our attention, because Enemy Mine, directed by Wolfgang Petersen, came out in 1985, and it was a box office bomb. It was not a big hit. It flopped at the box office. And I was thinking, though, I think one of the reasons why maybe this is something that Scott saw and I saw and it had the potential of being a cult hit is I feel like probably because it was a flop at the box office, but they had spent all this money on it. And it was one of those cases where they weren't necessarily trying to make a big blockbuster, but they ended up having creative differences with the original director. And then when Wolfgang Petersen came on, he wanted to basically didn't want to keep any of the original footage. So they had to do reshoots. They had to do some location changes. There's things in the contract with Louis Gossett Jr. and Dennis Quaid where they were getting paid even when they weren't working to hold them there to keep them going. So the budget kind of ballooned on them. And so they definitely lost money because this thing wasn't a big hit. But part of me wonders, one of the reasons why probably I liked it so much is I think I saw it a lot. I think what happened was because it was kind of a flop, they probably quickly brought it to video. So there's the opportunity to probably rent it pretty soon. And I'm guessing they sent kind of those contracts with the pay TV channels really quickly. And I've noticed, thinking back on First Choice, which was the pay TV subscriber that we had here in Ontario in the 1980s, I think how it worked was because I think of something like a Back to the Future or like an Indiana Jones or the big movies. I feel like they came out like once or twice that month. Like there's about three times you'd see them. But then there was those movies that were on like every single day. And my guess is some movies were just cheaper. The contracts where you could get, you were able to air this movie more times because it wasn't as much of a hit. And I feel like Enemy Mine may be one of those cases where 20th Century Fox was sort of like, yeah, for this amount, you could air it 100 times. And so I feel like it was on First Choice a lot. And that was back when there was only one channel. It's not like now where Crave has like six different channels. But I think it was on several times. So I think part of the reason that I had this affection for Enemy Mine is because I think I saw it so many times because it kept on being on First Choice. It's sort of the same thing of something like It's a Wonderful Life. Frank Capra's It's a Wonderful Life was a huge bomb in the box office. But now it's considered a classic because of rights issues. It ended up becoming, it didn't have rights anymore. So then networks could air it for free, I think, starting in the 70s. And so it ended up being a Christmas classic every year because they could air it without any charge. And so because people saw It's a Wonderful Life so many times, ended up becoming this classic because it was aired every single Christmas. But here's the thing, is with First Choice, there was a lot of movies that were probably cheap and were aired every single day. And I don't remember a lot of them. I didn't watch a lot of them. And so there was still something about Enemy Mine that drew me in. If I didn't like it, I would have just watched every time and just like, ah, this is on again. And I think part of it, the original appeal, is probably the same reason why it probably flopped. Because initially I'm like, oh, I love Star Wars. This is sci-fi. This is adventure. It turned out to not really be Star Wars. It turned out that Wolfgang Petersen wasn't really interested in being Star Wars. Because, yeah, there is some action sequences and there is a space sequence at the beginning. But what this is really about is two enemies from two different races, humans against the Drax. These two sort of warring factions are both sort of trying to take over the galaxy and get all the resources. They're marooned on a planet and they basically have to start understanding each other. They at first they're trying to kill each other, but eventually, because they're on this planet that is very hostile, this planet is very dangerous, they basically have to protect each other and they have to look out for each other. Then they become friends. And so that was very different than Star Wars. And because I was such a big Star Wars fan, I did watch every single Star Wars knockoff that there was around. I saw the Battle of the Stars and I saw this cartoon one that was like the Star Wars knockoff. I can't even remember its name now. Orin and the Sword or something. And there was all these Star Wars knockoffs and the Ice Pirates. And I most of them kind of in and out. Because I was just like, oh, well, this is trying to be Star Wars. It's not very good. This one connected to me because I saw it for sort of the space battles. I saw it for the aliens. And I was like, oh, this is something different.
I had a bit of a love-hate relationship with Enemy Mine at the beginning because I was expecting Star Wars. And the way the film begins, it sets up. Can I just say something too? If you're going to start a movie with a narrator, you know, I'm not the biggest fan of narrators. End the movie with the same narrator.
Yeah, well, that's one of the notes I put on for the show today because that was something I definitely wanted to discuss. And since you brought up, we could do it right now, is there's some interesting sort of choices in this movie. This is not a flawless picture. And I first do want to say that I can see where your love-hate relationship came with because this movie starts looking like you're getting these epic space battles because it starts with a space battle and it looks like it's going to be the space adventure. And it totally was trying to hook audiences, I think, at the beginning that you're going to be a space adventure. And it's not that movie. And that's kind of something I want to talk about, too, is sort of the jarring shifts and how the narrative changes quite a bit in this picture. And does it work or doesn't it? But you talk about sort of jarring shifts and maybe, like I talked about the ballooning budget. And I think that there was a lot of production issues with this picture. You had switching directors. And one of me wonders if it was kind of the narrator thing, too, where at one point it looks like Dennis Quaid's character is telling us this story from his past. But it's not Dennis Quaid in the end. It's someone else as if and that's really weird and sloppy. And even looking back at it, I wish they went the Star Wars route. I know maybe it might have been partly because they didn't want to copy Star Wars too much. So they didn't want to do an opening scroll. But you don't even have to do an opening scroll. You could just do a quick little visual right at the beginning, like sort of like Conan, where you just have a little bit of words. It doesn't have to scrawl or anything, a crawl or whatever. But I wish they did that route. But I think part of it is they didn't want to copy Star Wars. But I also think part of it is just, I think a lot of studios don't trust that people want to read And they think, we got to go with the narration instead. And I'm like, stop insulting your viewers. They can read a little bit. Because I get why I had narration at the beginning to sort of set up the world. No other point in the movie, though, did I think you ever needed a narrator again. There was no point in the movie where I needed Dennis Quaid to tell me that was happening. I was like, I see it. Like, I can figure it out. So I thought the narrator was a huge burden on the picture because it was jarring. It was unnecessary. It felt almost like insulting my intelligence. And maybe at the beginning you could have, like I said, an opening crawl. Like, you have sort of just a little bit to get you understand what this world is, know what's in the future, and that type of stuff. But other than that, I don't think you need it. And yeah, if you want to talk about sort of a production that had issues, that's the only answer I could come up with why there's two narrators. But I say, you don't need a narrator. But two, did Dennis Quaid just, he was done that day? Like, he was on lunch break and they had to get someone else?
Dennis went out for some shawarma. Get Randy in here then. The narrator, because I feel exactly like you. Once you get past the opening of the film, every time the narration comes up, it's discussing something that is very clearly obvious as to what's happening on the screen. And most of the times on the screen, it's just Dennis Quaid and Louis Gossett Jr. A few things threw me off when I was a kid and I was watching this. Number one, whole Star Wars thing and the way it starts out. These small ships battling. It's like, you know, oh, I've seen this. I love this. And then they go down onto planet and it becomes a drama. So that's the first thing that threw young Scott off, is the fact that it's a drama all of a sudden. The second thing that threw Scott off was the fact that, like, on the movie cover, it's got Louis Gossett Jr. and Dennis Quaid staring each other in the eye. You know, Louis Gossett Jr. is not in the whole movie because he dies giving birth, like a good champ should do. And so there were a few things in here, like I said, that threw off Scott. Young Scott, I should say. But it was still a positive, enthralling experience for me when I was a child, because even though there were a few things to disappoint me, there were, because I loved Louis Gossett Jr. and I love Dennis Quaid. They're both still early on in their career. Jaws 3D, that movie launched their careers. And you're probably thinking, Dennis Quaid, well, wasn't he in The Right Stuff? Are you really comparing Right Stuff with Jaws 3D? No, Jaws 3D launched both of their careers in the biggest way imaginable. And I say that because I watched the crap out of Jaws 3 for some reason. So, as a kid, when I saw Enemy Mine, I'm like, oh my, they got both the guys from Jaws 3.
It's time to confess this too. One of the other reasons why I was drawn to Enemy Mine is I actually got Dennis Quaid confused with Harrison Ford. I often thought movies that Dennis Quaid was in, I was like, oh, it's Harrison Ford. Usually while I watch, I realize, oh wait, that's not Harrison Ford. But a part of me wonders if some of the casting Dennis Quaid, like, he did have Right Stuff, but Right Stuff, I think, was actually a bit of a box office disappointment. And Jaws 3D probably did decent in the box office, I'm guessing. So that probably is what made him more of a star. But with audiences, I mean, obviously not with critics. I wonder, part of the casting is, like, he kind of looks like Harrison Ford, but probably cheaper.
Well, that's why, you know, during the, you know, mid to late 80s and into the 90s, you had actresses who kind of had a Meg Ryan look.
And this is not to disparage Dennis Quaid. He's very talented and he could very much lead a movie. I just, part of the back of my mind was like, I could have been the only dumb kid.
Oh, no, I was thrown off by stuff like that too. And the worst was, okay, so the whole Belushi thing. You know, as a kid, I'd see Belushi on VHS cover, and I would just assume, well, why would they throw that other Belushi in this movie? Obviously, this is the one I want to see.
Well, unfortunately, the one of the Belushis was too busy being dead.
That's the thing. And you would have thought that I would have learned that looking at a VHS box in the video store. Oh, Belushi. Well, this looks like it just came out, last year. Oh, that's interesting. Maybe they shot it before he died.
Is that why you rented Mary Sue?
Yes.
Wasn't he also the star of K-9, the knockoff of Turner and Hooch?
Yes, yes, indeed. And I did see K-9.
While watching Enemy Mine, and definitely thinking like that beginning with the action sequence and stuff. And I get that this is based off a novella. So, I mean, it's based off something that was in the Isaac Asimov Fantastic Stories magazine. And so there's a novella there written by Barry B. Longyear. So I get it's based off his thing and even won a Hugo. So this was, and Hugo was like a big science fiction award thing. It's still a big thing now, like the best science fiction novels, you want to win a Hugo. So I get all that literary, that this is something that did have some esteem. But part of me thinks that this is the type of movie where it got greenlit because of Star Wars, but they were trying to do like a Star Trek story.
It really sort of had that feel. And I guess that's why they got Wolfgang Peterson. Not that he made some good movies. He also made some bad movies. But when you think of who would do a Star Wars knockoff, you wouldn't think Wolfgang Peterson. And originally he was hesitant about this because he didn't want to do a Star Wars. Then when he read the script, he realized, oh, this is actually more about the individuals. This is people themselves. Young Scott, all of his things that threw him off about this movie that disappointed me, it was that story. It was the fact that at that point in time, I'd never seen anything like that before. I'd never seen a movie take an angle like that, really breaking down how you perceive the people that you're told to hate, how you perceive those people that you are just too happy, you know, to pull the trigger on. In the 80s, especially, mainstream movies, well, over the top, rah-rah, villains were just mowed down by the dozens by whoever it was that was waving the gun around from their hip. And so good and evil in a lot of 80s movies that I saw was just complete black and white. There are complete good guys, there are complete bad guys, there's no middle ground. That kind of environment, when I saw Enemy Mine, with the disappointments, with the things that threw me off, I was enthralled by it because of that story and because of the fact that I'm watching and kind of realizing as a kid that there's something else to the people who were told are the enemy.
Yeah, and that is definitely the stuff that drew me in too. I was a big, I had the Star Wars bed sheets, I had all the Star Wars toys, and by 1985, I'm also all in on Masters of the Universe. So I'm into monsters, I'm into space, I'm into fantasy. That's my jam, and that is clearly what got me into Enemy Mine. And like you, probably the first time around, I was sort of like, this isn't quite what I was expecting, but it went in a way, in a direction that I was not used to in narratives. I was very much like you. There's good and bad. And here, what I thought was the villain ends up being the friend, and they end up bonding. I end up caring about them. And it really, to me, I think that is what drew me in as a kid. Was, okay, this is a sci-fi story. Oh, but this is not what I was expecting. This is something new. It's opening my perspective. There could be sort of these gray areas where, and I don't think I noticed this as a kid, but rewatch it this time, I was like, Dennis Quaid character is actually kind of the villain for the first 30 minutes.
He is. He really is. And I love that because, you know, you mentioned being exposed to a different type of narrative, and there's multiple ways that both you and I have admitted we love telling the idea of or actively telling stories, you know, writing stories or whatever. And there are certain movie moments that kind of like flick light bulbs that stories can be told a different way. I've talked, you know, basically every time the movie Psycho has been mentioned, I talk about how for me it was this, wow, you can do whatever you want in telling a story. Enemy Mine, the fact that, so you've got this narrator, and as a kid, okay, the narrator speaks the truth. The narrator is the one that has the authority, and I guess probably I would have assumed that they're unbiased. The narrator is just about the facts. And then as the story plays out, our hero, by the time, probably about 20 minutes into the movie, I'm not feeling as pumped up for the hero because I'm starting to feel some empathy for Drac. You know, it starts to change. Like, why does he have to be such a jerk? It just sort of continues. And the movie played with the mind of young Scott in that way of, also, you know, from that storytelling perspective of who's the antagonist and who's the protagonist, and can those lines be blurred? Characters change into those things, or do our perceptions of the characters swap around who's who?
Yeah, definitely. And that is one of the big things that connected to me. And I think that's one of the reasons why Wolfgang Peterson is such a good hire as the director here, because this is the man who did Das Boot. And that's a picture where essentially they are asking you to empathize with Nazis, because that's what it is. It's World War II. They're stuck in a boat and he pulls it off. There is American audiences at the time that were enthralled and cheering for them, forgetting that these were supposed to be the enemy. So this is a man who clearly was interested in telling stories about complicated characters.
Yeah, and I think he does it really well. There's certain things that I don't think work extremely well in the film. As an actual story, I think the story works, characters work, the acting works. So the movie really is divided into Dennis Quaid, Louis Gossett Jr., and then Dennis Quaid and the offspring of Louis Gossett Jr., because ambisextrous.
Well, basically, they don't need a life partner. They're both male and female, and they can procreate. The Drax can, not humans, but I hope most listeners know that.
Yeah, so anyway, Zamas comes along, the little baby, and then the movie takes a much different tone. All of a sudden, it's a father-son thing, and they really play with the idea of this alien baby, you know, not understanding why the person raising him looks different than him. And so I think that tries to add a different and another dimension. Also in the movie is the appearance of base scavengers, but they are slavers. They use slave labor. They use the Drac as a slave. They run a mine, and according to, was it the writer of the novella? Well, anyways, apparently the mine, that whole angle wasn't in the novella. And the studio forced this subplot so that there would be a mine in the movie, so that when people saw the title Enemy Mine, it would make sense, I guess.
Now, I don't know much about the novella. Are the scavengers in the novella?
I don't believe so. I found it. Author Barry Longyear reported at a convention that the studio insisted on adding a subplot involving a mine, thinking the audience would not realize that the mine in the title was a possessive, as in my enemy, rather than an object. Now, if you want to talk about studios, you know, thinking their audiences are stupid, we'll have a narrator in here. Well, we already had one. What? They get another one. They need to know what's going on. This is like the epitome of, like, it's changing the story just for the sake of the title.
We're talking about sort of the two halves of this movie. And I will say that my favorite stuff in this movie is the Lou Gossett Jr. and Dennis Quaid bonding and them having to survive in this hostile environment, where one part they have to save one from that deadly pit monster with the giant tongue, and then the other one has to do it, and they have to stay away from these meteorites. Like, I really loved how the hostile environment caused them to have to bond, and this idea that even Dennis Quaid is willing to learn about the culture and learn about the language and wants to be immersed in it. And Louis Gossett Jr.'s character wants to learn more about sort of English and stuff. That's the stuff that I felt was most intriguing. And I really wish he did not pass away as quickly as he did. But because he was giving birth and it's a movie, you always have to die during childbirth. I mean, childbirth is just the most violent thing that could ever happen to someone. I think 90% of...
It's a death sentence.
90% of movies, that baby kills you, man. Those awful, awful things. I wish he didn't die that early, because that stuff was my favorite stuff. And I'm guessing the novella, though, is what led to then having to have the kid. And that's actually... I'm guessing that's following the novella. The second half is definitely not the strongest for me. I do like the fact, though, that due to his connection to the father or the mother or whatever you want to call him, due to the Drac, the love that he had for sort of the parent, that he then bonds with this kid. He takes on responsibility. So I like, even though I don't like that half as much, I do sort of like where that's going. I think the kid's kind of cute. I like that idea of him teaching, why do I look different than you? But you should still respect who you are. That's all good messages. And I thought it was done in a way that's not didactic. The football stuff was cute. All that stuff I do enjoy. I just wish almost in some ways it happened a little bit later in the movie because I wanted more of the Luke Gossett character. I actually forgot how early it happened. For some reason, my childhood memory was that's the very last bit of the movie. And it's really about the halfway point. So that's unfortunate. And so I wish sort of, yeah, that we kind of ended more with the son. And I say that because, and I'm glad now that you revealed that the scavengers seem to be sort of more of a creation of the novella, or sorry, a creation of studio interference, because I feel this movie's bookend by a studio saying, well, we need to have a Hollywood epic. We need to have a sci-fi adventure. You sort of have the space battle at the beginning, which is fine because it sets up why they're on that planet. But the scavengers, to me, are so unnecessary. And it's probably the most least interesting part of this movie because then it becomes generic action movie. It's now he has to save the boy and he has to battle the evil scavengers. It's almost like at some point someone didn't trust the fact that you could make a movie without a bad guy. That it couldn't just be the environment that's the bad guy. It couldn't just be the planet that was the bad guy. It couldn't be the relations and them overcoming because all that stuff's the most intriguing stuff. The stuff with the scavengers, it's so generic and so thrown together. And it's basically what went from a movie where I'm loving to, okay, I'm still recommending it. It's a 3-star movie, but it really felt like studio interference. And with you saying that stuff with the novella, now I know why it felt like it.
And it was, that's the thing, is it just, it turned so generic. I think there was a highlight something is I didn't watch it that many times. When I was a kid, certain movies I watched a lot. I watched Jaws 3 a lot, I can tell you that. I mean, hey, it launched 2 major careers in Dennis Quaid and Louis Gossett Jr. It landed Louis Gossett Jr. Iron Eagle. Come on. What else would have...
I watched that movie more than I want to admit. That was on first choice every day, too.
Talk about movies that are sort of forgotten to time. If you're listening and thinking, Iron Eagle, what was that? Well, they had like 5 of them.
People like planes.
People do like planes. And if we've learned anything years later, people still like planes. Louis Gossett Jr., that's how we got on Iron Eagle. Back to the story at hand. The reason I think that I didn't watch Enemy Mine over and over and over like I did some films is because I was enthralled with the drama stuff. I was enthralled with seeing 2 warring characters break down. They had to accept the person they're with. They chose to be vulnerable. That what being vulnerable wasn't something they had to do to survive. And I loved that story. I loved, even though, I mean, when you look at it, the speed and depth at which Louis Gossett Jr.'s character learns English. And I'm not just talking basic English. Like, there's some pretty, you know, in-depth, interesting words he uses. He understands idioms.
It's a 13th Warrior situation.
It is. You know, when I was watching the movie, I actually thought of the 13th Warrior. How did you learn our language? Because I listened. That was... And I'm not faulting the movie for that.
To be honest, I feel this movie, though, Enemy Mine, put more effort into him gradually doing the language and stuff like 13th Warrior. Of all the movies that do this, I think this is the one that actually put the most effort into it, make it the most believable. Because it took a day, at least.
Exactly, whereas 13th Warrior, he was sitting around a campfire with people. You know, I'll bash certain aspects of 13th Warrior, but I do have a soft spot for that film. There's just some joy to be had in there.
Me too.
But yeah, as a kid, the movie by the end didn't deliver what it had set up. Even though as a kid and I loved my action, I also loved interesting characters. And this movie at the core was interesting characters. And you've lost touch with those interesting characters. Like you, I give this movie 3 stars. It's got a lot of flaws. I wish it focused more on what the first half focused on.
I think I honestly feel even more so now with the novella news is the idea that this was just a studio being like, we need an action picture. We need action. And none of that, like the action is fine, but it doesn't even really make a lot of sense of how he got away and then how he got in there. And then like the people who then come after him, they don't even seem that mad that they just blew up half. He blew up like a big wall in the ship. They're just there to protect. Like all that stuff just really undermines heartfelt, dramatic elements of the first half. The second half of the movie really undermines all the work of making this more contemplative and more deep and complex. Because the last half is just, or not the last half, the final act is basically just pure action picture. And here's the thing is, I do think the scavengers are just there because they needed villains. They don't even really make sense. Like, I don't really even understand. Because, like, the Earthlings and the Drac are basically going and mining areas. And then we also have the scavengers, and people are accepting them, but they also know them as bad guys. Like, the scavengers are so poorly conceived of what they even mean. But the unfortunate thing is, as much as I don't think the scavengers work, it's always great to see Briar and James. And I think he is really fun as the villain, even though it's like, I don't care about the scavengers. If you're going to try to get me at least halfway into the scavengers, you make Brian James, who is like 80s villain icon, as the leader. Because he's fun. Even if I think the scavengers are useless, I was happy to see Brian James.
For the little bit that he was in there. And I like the point you brought up, because I didn't think of this. So the Drac, they're all about mining. Like, the war's over mining. Who gets it? Like, nobody wants to share the mining. So the Drac are willing to, I'm going to fight to the death. The humans are, I'm going to fight to the death. Well, these scavengers, who cares? They're just mining a bunch of stuff. Yeah, the stuff you're fighting to the death over.
It doesn't make any sense at all. They were such unnecessary characters. You just need villains. But like I said, I'm happy to see Brian James. And I think this leads to another point. I feel this has action elements because the studios felt like the only way we could get people coming to the theater is action elements. Because I don't think any of the action elements are necessary. I don't even think the opening space battle is necessary. You could almost start with them just kind of crashing on the ship to really set the tone that this is not an action picture. To me, the best action stuff was their fight for survival. Like, stay away from the meteorites. Survive that creature that's going after them. I would have loved more kind of creatures and the atmosphere and just different things, the environment coming after them. Because I think just that alone, the two of them for the whole movie trying to survive on the planet, I think it could have been a classic.
I actually kind of feel like having that opening, I liked it for two reasons. Number one, it's going to throw off what you expect. You're gonna be, you know, sucker punched. And I like it when I'm sucker punched, usually if it's done well. And number two, and I'm not saying the dialogue was good at all, or the acting in the spaceships, I'm not saying any of that was good. What it did for me was it showed the venomous hatred that the humans did have for the Drac.
Yeah, I sort of feel you don't need them, but yeah, those are actually really good points. And you are saying that the dialogue isn't great and the acting wasn't great, but I will counter with that stuff is just dripping with 80s charm.
And I'm not going to bash you over that. If you recall our very first year of podcasting, I watched a certain film and I thought that the horrible dialogue and acting and line delivery was an homage to horrible dialogue, acting, and line delivery of the 80s. That was Texas Chainsaw 3D. And if you're listening, you're like, wow, you love Jaws 3D, Texas Chainsaw 3D. Put anything in 3D and I'll love it. Oh, gosh, I can't get enough of that stuff. So I have a huge affection. And one of the reasons why Return of the Living Dead is one of my favorite zombie films of all time.
It's because you saw it in 3D.
I would have if they had the option. Absolutely. But I love, because in that movie, it's intentional. Look how bad this dialogue is in, you know, in the movies. You know, punks walking down the street. Oh, I just want to party. And because when you watch a Friday the 13th film, and you, because you'll hear dialogue like that, and you know, this is how they actually think teenagers talk.
Do you think, going way, way back to early in the podcast, what we're talking about, but do you think that this movie was a flop in 1985 because of a lot of the reasons of why we actually liked it? Like, part of me thinks that I don't remember the marketing in 85. I don't remember at all what type of marketing there was. I'm guessing there was a pretty big marketing campaign based on what the budget would have been at the time. And I was aware of this movie. My guess is the marketing was promising an action picture. And then you get this. And I wonder if just people... It's sort of the same thing with, like, you think of Blade Runner and you think of Thing. Both those movies are loved now. They're cult hits. But they were actually really big flops at the time. And it's kind of Blade Runner. People were expecting Star Wars again. The Thing's coming right out after E.T. These are movies that are coming out against sort of audience expectations. And I think Enemy Mine, one of the reasons why it's probably a cult hit, is it came out at the wrong time.
It did come out at the wrong time. And I don't remember any of the marketing, but I am guessing completely that the marketing was full of the beginning of the movie, people running, things looking dangerous, and that's never a good thing. I like the idea of being caught off guard by a film when I'm watching it compared to what the trailer showed, but you can't portray the movie as something that it's not. You can't portray a film as just, you know, a standard dialogue-driven film and then have people show up and be like, wow, this is a full-fledged musical, because it's not gonna go well for you. And coming out a few years after Return of the Jedi, if you're putting any of the spaceships in your marketing, you as someone who's paid to market stuff, you know what people are expecting when they see it.
Yeah, you're not being very honest. I wanted to confirm it. Yeah, so Last Starfighter came out the year before. So it came out in 1984. So it really does give you an idea of what kind of sci-fi movies were going at the mainstream level. Like Last Starfighter is much more kind of sticking with the Star Wars mold, maybe a little bit of E.T. because you're at home and boy wanting more, which again, it's kind of packaging two big hits. And Enemy Mine is, yeah, more kind of leading into Star Trek, which isn't kind of the same kind of box office hit or appeal. And so it's coming from a very different place. And one of the things that is interesting here is I'm kind of trying to think, how did Enemy Mine stack up to other action movies or other sci-fi movies? And I think one of the things that really makes it so different is the fact that the 1980s really is sort of what you said before. It's very cut and dry. It's very black and white. It's Red Dawn. It's the high school kids having to fight against the evil Russians, the heroes against the bad guys. It's Rambo. It's, again, Last Starfighter. It's very clear who's good, who's bad. And Star Wars is very same, to the point where they wear the outfits to let you know who's bad. And so here's a picture that I think it's interesting, because we talked about how it was released at the wrong time, but at the same time, I think it was really important, because you're during a time where we're being told communists are bad, Iran is bad, these people who are different than us are bad. And this is a picture that's saying people different than us, yes, we have conflict, yes, we have opposition, but that doesn't mean that they're necessarily bad, they're different. And what we really need to do is understand people. Like, the Enemy Mine message, in a lot of ways, was so important because there was nothing else like it in Hollywood at that point. It was so much more of, if they're different, you attack them and you kill them. And this movie is saying, well, maybe you take the time to understand them a bit better. And I think that's one of the things that's made something like Enemy Mine probably a cult hit, is because the message still applies today. We still need to hear the idea of maybe we should understand instead of attack.
You know the movie that people never talk about? Toy Soldiers. When you talk about that whole Red Dawn, the kids rising up, let's remember Toy Soldiers. And who was in it? Who was the principal of that boarding school? Louis Gossett Jr. Even though the guy is plastered in makeup, and prosthetics and everything like that. He talks not only with an accent, but a gurgle. You would never be able to just say, oh, that's Louis Gossett Jr. I think that his performance in here is absolutely terrific. He gives a lot of emotion from under these layers of makeup and prosthetics. And he is able to, like I said before, the opening sequence of Dennis Quaid trying to kill Drac, I started feeling sorry for the alien. And that comes down to, number one, I think the directing, but also to the performance from Louis Gossett Jr., who was able to start to humanize this alien. And yeah, I think that he was great. And Dennis Quaid, things got cheesy when Zemeckis came along, when the little baby came along and they're, you know, playing football with some trees.
Hey, I have to say something. Okay, I am not going to argue that the football stuff was cheesy, or maybe even the montage was cheesy. I will give that to you. But maybe I just have to be like, I'm a dad and I'm also a giant sap. I kind of like that stuff.
So I kind of liked it too. I'm not bashing the football. Like, this is, the football is one of those things where you're like, it's awful. It's awful, but I liked it. You know, I'm not bashing it. I recognize it for what it is, but I did like it because they're playing football with trees. I mean, okay, see, this is the thing. Certain things will always work. Like, you could do something silly and crazy. Slow motion soup. Somehow that worked. Coming home with a replacement child. Your child got murdered. But honey, look, I brought a new one home. That's the thing. Some things are just so oddball and stupid, but they bring a charm. They bring something where you're like, okay, you got me. Yeah, you got me on that one.
And here's the thing. You're talking about the performances of Dennis Quaid, Louis Gossett Jr. And here's the thing is, I don't think the dialogue ever actually gets better in this movie. You're talking about the dialogue is kind of cheesy at the beginning. I think the dialogue is fairly cheesy all the way through. But I'm connected to this movie. And I think that tells you that the performances are really strong. Because this is not necessarily the most believable storytelling. There's even some times where all of a sudden they're mad at each other again, and you're like, huh? Like, there's things here that are very jarring or very almost like off fast forward so we can get through these emotions because they got to get to the kid and then you got to get to the scavengers, so we got to rush through this stuff. So some of this stuff isn't necessarily like the best paced, or definitely the dialogue is not something that feels very natural. But I am immersed and I'm caring about these two people, because both these guys are really selling it. Dennis Quaid, at the beginning, he is acting like the action hero. He's the Han Solo. He is the hero. As you're observing, you're realizing, is he the hero, though? He's not doing these great things. And then he gets humbled, and he starts learning about Jareba, who is the Drac. And he starts calling him Jerry, and they start becoming friends. And there's this moment where Dennis Quaid starts becoming more humble in his performance. He almost starts putting his shoulders down. There's a part where he starts to almost seem like he's opening himself up. Like, there is this humility that's coming from the performance that you don't see at the beginning. It doesn't have the same confidence. He seems like a bit more of a broken man. And so even if the dialogue's not necessarily working and the narrative isn't perfect, I think the performances are telling us what we're supposed to feel. And here's a guy who's getting beamed down by the environment. Here's a guy who's lonely. Here's a guy who feels helpless. And he has to rely on this guy, on this other person, on Jerry, on his enemy. But he's beginning to respect him. And he's beginning to become more open-minded. And it's making him a better person. And I think all that is coming from the performance of Dennis Quaid. I think it is definitely, you can see why this is a guy who's been around for decades. Because he really sells his character, even with maybe the script not necessarily being as strong as it could be. And yeah, Lou Scottson Jr., I mean, yeah, he has a prosthetics, but he is believable as an alien. Like, he's making those noises as far as I can tell. And the way that he delivers the language, even though he learns it really quick, you still get an idea of this guy who's still kind of tentative about it. He's kind of going out of his comfort zone in order to reach out and connect to this guy. I like the fact that very early on, he's able to convey a guy who also sort of has confidence, but he's also a little bit kind of broken. He's also kind of out of his wits, but he doesn't want to reveal it to his enemy. And that kind of stuff is things that the actors are bringing to this. And also, I'm sure Wolfgang Peterson sort of like led them that way. And that's what makes this movie work. Like, the performances is what brings this up to the level it's at for me.
I completely agree. It really does. What about, here's the question. And this one is a yes, and for me is a yes and no answer. The special effects and set design, did they enhance it? And did they elevate it for me? And in some areas, yes, absolutely they did. And then other times, I have to say certain things made me feel like I was watching a B-movie, which is interesting because when Wolfgang Peterson came on and he saw the footage from the previous director, Richard Loncrane, it was described as 50s B-movie looking stuff. They had to completely redo the costume design, and there are some things in here that I do think don't look great, but there are certain things that I think they did amazingly well. I'm not a German, so I don't know how to say this properly. Rolf Zehetbauer, he worked with Wolfgang Peterson on Das Boot and as a production designer. And I think the production design here is done really, really well. The interior of the small fighter ships, I mean, that was kind of basic stuff. But once they got to the planet, I felt like there was some really interesting work done to make it feel like not just an alien environment, but to make it feel hostile, to make it feel dangerous, desolate, to totally remove any feeling of hope from the viewer and from the characters. And then in the special effects and makeup side of things, Chris Wallace, who I believe was the lead on this, because he had a company, Chris Wallace Inc., doing the makeup, doing the special effects. And he's someone who worked on, he was one of the creators of Gremlins. He worked on Return of the Jedi. He did the creature effects in The Fly, creature effects in Arachnophobia. So it's pretty easy to see right away he's got quite a resume. And then also working with him was Brian Wade, who has this massive, massive list of accomplishments as well, from, you know, doing Friday the 13th and Nightmare on Elm Street films, to working, he's not lead, but working with Stan Winston Studios on The Terminator. They're both really, really experienced people who have been in some, done some amazing, amazing work. One of them even assisted on The Thing, I believe. When you see Louis Gossett Jr.'s character, at first we see him from a distance, but when you see him face up, there's a lot of attention to detail to this character. It's sort of like a work of art. This is very meticulous stuff to make him, you know, they're described as lizard creatures almost. And that is portrayed through the makeup and the prosthetics. And it's done in a way that when I was a kid, I was like, oh my gosh, this looks amazing. And even today, yeah, you know what? Times have changed and effects have gotten better. But sometimes certain things just, they're nailed. And I really feel like that aspect of the special effects was completely nailed in this film.
Yeah, through a 1985 lens, looking at this picture in 1985, I think the special effects are fantastic. I remember them wowing me as a kid. And I think, like, there's some here that I wouldn't think there was any bad special effects if they're in 85. I'd say there's some that don't age well. But I find, like, through an 85 lens, they're all good. But there's some maybe the flight scenes at the beginning aren't their strongest compared to something like Star Wars, maybe even Last Starfighter at the time that had a bit more personality. And that's more my criticism. Isn't necessarily that they're bad. They're just, like you said, nothing really exciting, nothing really fresh. It kind of, like, even the ship they chose is like, oh, that looks like something from 2001, A Space Odyssey. And that was in the 1960s. But once you get to the planet, I think the set designs are awesome. They do a great job of making that place seem hostile. I think they do a great job of making it look like a real place. I think it was actually on a studio. They were scouting parts of Africa, but they couldn't find anything they liked. So they used a studio, I guess, in Germany. And it looks great. Like, I think it looks like a real living, hostile environment. The creature that they make with a big long tongue that comes out of the pit, you don't see him too much, but I think he looks kind of cool. That thing with the shell that's moving around, all that stuff to me looks really solid. But yeah, the work of art, the masterpiece, is definitely what they did with the Drax. The Drax are really, really great, and especially Jerry, who is the Luke Gossett Jr. character. He's incredible, and it's exactly what you said. All the little details, all the little bits. You can't tell looking at that that's Lou Gossett Jr. He looks unique. It's not a derivative-looking character. It doesn't look like something from Star Trek. It doesn't look like something from Star Wars. It looks like a fresh, new creature, and there's all these cool little things, like the back of the head, there's like details, the front of the face, how they do the lips. There's just some interesting character design there. And I would say it's up there with the Thing when it comes to work of art, like some great creative ideas. And so that creature's the best. But I largely thought that the special effects did a good job of immersing you. And this is a movie that I do kind of wish, I mean, there's never going to be a re-release, but there is. This would, I think, look really good on the big screen.
I think it would. It's unfortunate because you do have these brilliant aspects, like, you know, certain set designs, and as well as special effects. And then there's other times where, yeah, it's passable.
Well, I would say the one that doesn't work great for me, if we're nitpicking now, one that doesn't work great for me is we're supposed to see these meteor showers as this massive big threat. And it basically just looked like exploding lights.
Yeah, that was a bit disappointing. Battle in space that leads to a really dramatic interchange between two characters that turns into tragedy, that turns into aw shucks fatherhood, that turns into tragedy, that turns into I'm John Rambo, but I fly spaceships. Let's just say the pacing is kind of all over the place.
Oh, and I should note, you know it's a 1980s movie because the final battle is in a fire and smoke factory.
we have a few films to thank for that.
Yeah, I do like the, like you said, some of the tonal shifts. I think when you do sort of these jumping around, it makes a movie feel a little bit more epic. It makes it feel a little bit more fresh when you have a little bit of action, you have a little bit of drama, you have all these little elements. My biggest issue really is the fact that my favorite part is, again, the building relationship. I think the beginning of that is really good. I thought that part was really paced. They took their time. They have some scenes. But then I felt like because they realized, oh, we got to get to the scavengers and we got to get to the kid, then they started rushing it. Like, all of a sudden, now he's pregnant. And I thought there was a lot more still to be had. I thought there was a lot more of surviving in the environment and even him. Because, like, basically, once he gets pregnant, he's not even teaching him anymore about his culture. Like, all these things that at one point seemed important to the movie gets dropped because, well, we got to get rid of him now, bring on the kid and bring on the scavengers. And so in that aspect, I think that the pacing is a little off, or the editing is a little off, because I think we lose large chunks of what would be the most intriguing part of the story. And I know I've said it several times in this, but it really is, this movie, the best part is about 40 minutes, and it's these two characters bonding. And I did think the pacing was strong until, like I said, once he got pregnant. And I think that's more because of, again, studio interference saying, we got to get to the scavengers, we got to get to the cute kid, we got to get to that stuff.
I completely agree. Also, you had mentioned much, much earlier in this episode about how there was some really abrasive moments as far as all of a sudden they're mad at each other or whatnot. I
would again say editing pacing.
Yes, exactly. I was going to say that I feel like the editing room is where some of that stuff became an issue, because, I mean, the movie's got flaws in almost every aspect. And in the editing, sometimes the editing is great, because I feel like through that 40 minutes, and I'll call them the wondrous 40 of the film, it is kind of abrasive at times, but you still feel a flow. Like, all of a sudden, he's like, oh, hey, he's speaking the language. Oh, hey, look, he's got a beard. Look at this.
You know what that beard did, though? It reminded me of Rise of the Planet of the Apes, where one of your frustrations was this was supposed to be over several years, but they never looked different. And you're like, well, even just give him a mustache, give him something. And they did nothing. And so what I did appreciate about this movie is what something a lot of movies forget to do. They don't change the character's look. That they at least had the idea of like, well, we got to grow a beard because that shows that things are going longer. And plus, he probably didn't bring a shaving kit.
Oddly enough, the emergency rations on his ship did not include anything by Gillette. So therefore, he was stuck in this literal hell of surviving with a beard. And yeah, that was the thing. Like, it kind of sounds nitpicky about Rise of the Planet of the Apes, but you're telling a story over 10 years, I think it was. I may have similarities to how I looked 10 years ago, but people do change. And so I do like when movies think about that. And I kind of feel like many things in the film, there was a good reason and a bad reason for the beard. The good reason was to show, to basically show this is wild survival. The second one is to make up for storytelling and editing issues.
Speaking of editing issues, I have a huge, huge question. Or sort of just something that kind of jumped out at me. The three characters that are from sort of the Federation that Quaid is part of, and they try to stop him to go back, and then they go down there. I feel like the movie is leaning on the fact that he knows these three really well, and he has a relationship with them. Even the girl seems to really care about him a lot. Do you think that there is a whole part of, and I'm not saying we need it in the movie because it would have made it probably too long, but do you think there's a whole part of them having some kind of relationship that's on the editing floor?
Absolutely, because this one really caught me off guard. Because, like, all of a sudden, abrupt cut to clean-shaven Dennis Quaid, looking young, looking good, walking through the corridor of a spaceship with two people who just, like, well, this can't be White Balloon or whoever was referenced earlier in the film, because she's not in a, like, who are these people? And there is a rapport. There's something there that makes me think, okay, they know each other, but okay, there's a few editing moments that really stand out. And that I think is the worst one, because I feel like a lot of story was missed because of that.
Because I also think the movie thinks that we care about these three people.
Yeah, which we don't. We absolutely don't.
No, because I have no clue who they are. I don't even know why they care that Quaid went back. And it's not, they're not even there to arrest him. It looks like they're there just to protect him. And I was like, huh?
Yeah, that was just odd.
And don't those three people hate Drax? They seem to be cool with them.
The end was a mess. You know, it's interesting because when I watched this back then, even if I was adult Scott now watching it back then, and you said, well, this is going to end up becoming a cult classic, I'd probably give you a bit of a cockeyed look and say it's like, it's a decent movie, but it's not going to be a cult classic. That's the interesting thing about cult classics, is you can't predict what's going to be that. Cult classics are essentially the idea of something going viral before the internet came out. It's a movie that, you know, no one liked, no one cared for, didn't see, but then something sparks it in a movie community, and the word of that film spreads through colleges, and it essentially, like I said, it not viral on a mainstream level, but viral amongst a certain group of people who would be drawn to that. With all of its flaws, but that's all balanced out by some really, really intriguing ideas, makeup, production design, acting. Definitely is that kind of film where I look at now and say, I can see why people are into it, because it does capture something unique.
And we keep on sort of saying, oh, there's all these flaws, and we pointed them out, and I agree with you. But I think you'd also agree with me, because you said you gave it 3 stars as well, that the positives are strong enough to outweigh all those flaws. And that's probably helps with the endurance, is the good stuff rises above some of the scripting issues and definitely editing issues and some of those. I think I'm going to guess, this is me, I'm going to guess there's 3 reasons why this is potentially became a cult hit. One is, I do think it's the special effects and the creature design. because I think that they seem pretty, other than the ships, again, I think they look pretty cool and fresh and different than some other movies at the time. Number two is the fact that if you look at 80s sci-fi, this is a very different movie than anything else from the 1980s. And so I think that helps. It's the same thing with like Big Trouble in Little China, The Thing, there's Blade Runner. What else is like those movies during that decade? And so that's what helped them endure. And I think the three is just the idea that if I'm right in that it was on TV a lot, is it's just our generation is remembering this fondly because they saw it as a kid.
Yeah. And I mean, it is the kind of movie, if you did see it as a kid, it would take you by surprise because you have most definitely you have something that you're anticipating and expecting from it. And you're not going to get that. So you're going to get walloped by something completely different. You know, I think it does it in a very good way. And, you know, I can see with certain people how it wouldn't resonate. But with other people, and I'm not saying this is bad, just some people don't like to be caught off guard in movies. They want to know what they're getting into. I like being blindsided, which is why I try not to watch trailers for anything because I want to be tossed around in the story.
And I would still say that probably Rocky is the king of the montages. But during a decade in the 80s, when you needed a montage in order to be greenlit, I had a lot of pleasure seeing a montage again in this movie. And I think we got three. Two of them are traveling montages, as we got music again to see Dennis Quaid go over the landscape. And then there's a delightful montage because, well, we don't want to take the time for this baby to grow. So let's just montage him up to a talking age. And I thought they were wonderful. They are very cheesy, just like the dialogue. So I will not deny that you kind of roll your eyes, but it was a roll of the eyes with a grin.
Anything and everything can work. Certain things you might think are always just going to be failures, like playing football with trees, but everything can work. And whether it's in the context of what the creators wanted it to be or not, it doesn't matter. And yeah, certain things are fun and certain things can work.
And I think part of the reason why the montages work for me is I really thought this was a pretty solid score. Because the score to me did not sound like, oh, let's just mimic Star Wars. Like, it didn't seem like a rehash. Because I felt like in the 80s, you'd have a lot of like, oh, you could tell they're inspired by Indiana Jones or they're inspired by this thing. This seemed like a score that rather than trying to be like epic space adventure, it was more melodic. It was more almost like fit with the movie. Like, it almost felt internalized. It had more emotion. There was more melancholy to the score. It felt like the score was kind of fitting with the feelings of the characters. And so I thought the music by Maurice Jarre really accompanied the picture. And so we've been talking about the special effects, but I think another reason why I connected to this movie, special effects, performances, and I thought the score is an unsung hero.
It is. And I think was probably the most consistent aspect of the film.
I know when I was a kid, my favorite part of the movie, I think, was like the monster pulling them into the dirt because I was a kid and I liked monsters. So that was definitely what I thought was cool as a kid. I think now, we've said it so many times, I think my favorite stuff this time, what really kind of resonated with me, as cheesy as it is, I like the initial scene with the kid where he was telling the kid sort of who he is and be proud of who he is, because I think it showed the growth of the Dennis Quaid character. It's the first time where you really get the idea that he's become more accepting of Drax and he's a new man than he was at the beginning. We actually had a character arc here. And so him trying to encourage the kid, I thought was a good moment. And then I liked when he started wanting to know more about the culture of the Drak. I think that is one of my favorite parts. I also like the fact that when he disparages this character who means a lot, that his counter is, well, you disparaged Mickey Mouse. I enjoyed that
too.
I love that because that was one of those, like, I'm guessing this was in the novella. It was one of those things where as a viewer with an understanding of human history, you know, this comment about Mickey Mouse means nothing, right? Like Mickey Mouse is like a cultural character and made an impact. It just shows that innocence and the lack of understanding as to how Drax took it. And it's a tiny little moment, but I thought it was brilliant.
Yeah, and I guess that's probably why we keep on harping a little bit on the negatives, because I think the brilliant moments of this movie, the good moments of this movie, are almost classic level.
They are. This deserves to be a film that is remembered. I'm glad it's got cult status, because it deserves it. It deserves to be to live on. It came out at an unfortunate time, and a few weeks ago we talked about, you know, the comparison of the 80s and today, as far as now it's all about IP and getting the recognizable name, and back then it was about imitating the big movies. You weren't necessarily going for IPs, you were going to imitate IPs.
Yeah.
And that was what things were at the time. And Enemy Mine, because of when it came out and what the studios would have wanted and all that, it got greenlit because it came out at the right time. But creatively and audience wise it came out at the wrong time.
I am gonna regret saying this, and I don't even think I truly believe it, but there's a little part of me that almost kind of wishes that someone like Blumhouse took this picture and did a version where it's just the two of them trapped on the planet.
I agree. I'd watch that.
Because I think if you have a good enough director, the budget doesn't need to be huge. You could sort of pull it off. I don't know, $5 million is probably maybe make it too small, but I think you could do something similar, because that idea of two people trapped together, I think it's almost timeless and epic. It would be really interesting in the battle of the environments. I mean, we reviewed Riddick years ago, and neither of us recommended it, but both of us said the best part of that movie, and we would have recommended if there was more of it, was when it was just Riddick trapped on that planet for like 40 minutes.
Yeah, that movie had potential, but that, and much like Enemy Mine, it's very abrasive. You have different things going on. Okay, now we're in this section. Now we're in this section. And yeah, they both suffered from the same sort of problem. So well done on you bringing that up.
Now, do you think, because I did a little bit of research, I couldn't find anything. Like, Enemy Mine, we've mentioned sort of it's kind of a cult classic, but I would say it wouldn't be the same level as like a Thing or Blade Runner, the other ones I mentioned today for sure. I'd say it was kind of lower end, because even with Disney Plus, you have to do some searching to actually find it to watch it. I mean, I had to type out half the title before it's like, oh, you actually want to see this. So it's definitely not something that they consider as one of their pillar pictures or anything. Do you think this picture did have any influence on filmmakers today? Do you think there is any kind of legacy, not necessarily from a fan level, but from a filmmaker level? Because I'm trying to think in my head of any movies, because I can't really think of one that were like, oh yeah, Enemy Mine would have influenced that.
Yeah, it's one of those films where the things that I think would influence people are more from a narrative nature and more from a subtlety aspect. So I don't think I could easily just point out, oh, that was, you know, influenced by, but I know there's got to be people out there, a bunch of people who definitely remember it from our childhood and being caught off guard by what it was.
Yeah, I guess the best way to put it is sort of that former enemies having to join together kind of influence, which existed before this movie, but it would have been the first time that I think at a mainstream sci-fi feature level in the theater that they would have tried this in probably at least 20 years. So I think that's probably its biggest influence, is sort of maybe young filmmakers looking like, oh, you don't need to have black and white storytelling. Sci-fi can actually have complicated characters.
It can. And I think, you know, you mentioned Star Trek earlier, and it really sort of is a blend of both. I think it's a blend of, I think the Star Wars aspect is because of the time it came out in it, and it needed to have that from a studio standpoint, but then it goes in a Star Trek direction because it is more about philosophies and sort of deeper intellectual stuff.
It's interesting because Roland Emmerich was taken to task for the second Independence Day for good reason, of the idea of people saying like, oh, that sort of that alien who came there with peace at the beginning of the movie that people want to attack, that was the most compelling part of the movie. And Roland Emmerich sort of said, yeah, you're right, But no one's going to watch a movie without clear villains. No one's going to watch a movie with aliens that are just good. And that's why he had to have the aliens return. It had to become an action picture. It ended up being a flop, so it didn't work. And it's interesting because I've thought about that a lot, about how wrong he is, about how the fact that that actually isn't true. Like, you could say Enemy Mine, okay, but it wasn't a hit. But would have actually done better if they left those scavengers out? Would have done better if the film, maybe not necessarily filmmakers, but the studios trusted and just made up these two characters? Because, I mean, again, Arrival wasn't a blockbuster hit, but Arrival has aliens that are not villains. And I think it did fairly well in the box office for its budget. And so there is signs that this kind of storytelling does grab the attention of audiences.
Yeah, and people are smarter than studios and some directors, you know, give them credit. Okay, so Arrival worldwide did $203 million on a budget of $47 million. And I'm just going to say, like, talking about budgets and what you see on screen, that movie, when you look at how beautiful that film is, Villeneuve did this with $47 million. I know a lot of people probably look at older films and roll their eyes at special effects that haven't aged well, but trying to remember what things were like at the time and the work and the imagination that went in. Yeah, I think Enemy Mine is just an absolute perfect example of how, you know, the right people can make something look absolutely brilliant.
And in the case of like a Raiders, and in the case of like Star Wars before it got special editioned, and in the case of Enemy Mine, and definitely The Thing, I believe that, and Terminator even, some of these, you look at them like, oh, how well did that age? But in all those, there's an artistry still to them. I appreciate it because there's this artistic feel. These look like someone who actually took the time to craft these. And so even though like, oh, that doesn't actually look like how a creature actually would be, or there's aspects in this picture you could say that doesn't totally look realistic, it still looks artistic. And so that's sort of why I accept it. Well, compared to something more modern from, I think it was 2013, R.A.P.D., where it looked aged when we were in the theater.
It really did look aged.
You know, my children, I mention sometimes on this podcast, and they have been asking me every single day if it's December yet. Because December means then they can start asking me, is it Christmas yet? And that is right around the corner. And so, speaking of Christmas, this week's question, we want to ask you, what is your favorite non-Christmas holiday movie? Because there's a lot of Christmas movies out there. There's new Christmas movies every single year, but there's other holidays. So which ones do you like that are not centered on Christmas?
Well, I would say April Fool's Day. So, and if you want to let us know what your answers to that question are, you can do so via email through themoviebreakdown@gmail.com. On Twitter, we are @moviebreakdown1. On Facebook, we are @themoviebreakdown. As well, please do subscribe, rate, review, whatever you can for our podcast on Spreaker, Spotify, Stitcher, Apple Podcast, Amazon Music, or wherever it is that you listen to podcasts. All that stuff always helps us out. And you can also share us on the social media until you quit the social media, because the social media is bad. And you can also head over to our site, Beyond the Balcony, where you can check out our works, which lately it's just been Chris, because Scott's been a slovenly fool. And hoping to change that around, you can get to Beyond the Balcony by going to beyondbalcony.com.
Well, Scott has done the heavy lifting for most of the year, so it's all right if he took a little bit of break. There has been some great stuff from Scott all year round. I cannot say there's been great stuff from me necessarily this month, though, due to sort of day job, and then when I don't have my day job, family, and then after that, I'm trying to write a novel in a month, and I'm right now at 63,000 words, and that's almost done, but that's occupied a lot of my time. So I do have to admit that there hasn't been tons of fresh stuff on there, but we do have the Ted Bundy American Psycho review up there, and you can see how much I hate that movie. The title is "An Awful Movie About an Awful Man." I also talk about 8 magazines that I loved as a kid. There's a lot of different reposts up there, again, because of the time thing. I do talk a little bit about writing. I talk about something that I confess about how much I don't care about plot holes and how many there are in this novel I'm currently writing. And so there's all that type of stuff. And one post I really do want to spotlight is I have a piece called One of My Proudest Dad Moments. And my kids did some things recently I found out from the principal that just almost made me cry. And during this time of social media where it's all about being hostile and arguing and there's so much toxicity and that we praise these figures that seem to be just so narcissistic and selfish, my children showed some incredible acts of kindness, and we need more of those in the world, and they inspired me. So you can also read that piece along with some of the reposts. But this week, I do plan on posting lots of different reviews, and I think I want to end the year with the way that I wanted the whole year to be, which is a lot of new releases, a lot of different reviews, and get us ready for what will be the best year ever on the site in 2023.
It's going to be a hoot.
So we had mentioned about non-Christmas holiday movies that are great, and we will be talking about one next week. It's actually about American Thanksgiving, about just a dad trying to get home to his family and the slob that follows him. It's much like this podcast. And so next week, we will be looking at Plane, Trains, and Automobiles, a picture that I put as one of my favorite kind of holiday movies. Scott confessed he hadn't seen it. It is a John Hughes picture, Steve Martin, John Candy, some beautiful 1980s humor will be coming your way next week. It's a little after American Thanksgiving, but you know what? It's okay to have leftovers.
Join us then. Thank you very much for listening, everybody. I'm Scott Martin.
Yes, thank you so much for tuning in this week. We really appreciate you guys, and we'll see you next week. I'm Christopher Spicer.
Take care, everyone.
Have a great week. At the movies.